fine arguments and your briefs. We'll move on to the second case of the day, Champion versus Holder, 093065. Whenever you're ready, Mr. Floss.
Good morning. May it please the Court. John Floss on behalf of Petitioner Appellant Ms. Olaronke Champion. Just a brief set of facts relevant to her case here. She entered the country in 1988 with a B-2 visitor visa, which she subsequently overstayed. She has three children in the United States, two of which are United States citizens, aged 16 and 13. She was placed in removal proceedings in 2005 following an unsuccessful attempt to adjust her status to that of lawful permanent resident. She sought the relief known as cancellation of removal pursuant to 8 U.S.C. 1229B, subsection B. And after stipulations by the government, the only contested issue was whether or not her children would suffer exceptional, extreme, unusual hardship should she be deported to Nigeria.
Can you tell us what the situation is with respect to the father? Are removal proceedings pending against him?
Removal proceedings are pending right now. He has not had a final hearing yet. After her hearing, she provided mixed testimony as to whether she would bring her children with her. Despite this mixed testimony, the immigration judge did not allow her to testify to the hardships to her children in Nigeria, including the possibility of female genital mutilation, and did not allow her attorney to present a closing argument despite his request to do so. The judge held against him.
She had various opportunities, did she not, to present her position to the arbitrator?
She tried to, Your Honor, and when she tried to comment initially on the female genital mutilation that she had suffered through, the government attorney objected, and the immigration judge essentially cut off the testimony of that part, reiterating the objection that the government attorney had raised.
That didn't get before the court at all, not just in closing argument.
No,
because she didn't get the opportunity for closing, but period.
Correct. Not only just that aspect, to any of the, the financials, the fact that the children don't speak any of the language or have never been to Nigeria before, none of those were raised before the court and were entered into the record. So her first actual argument here is that this denial of the opportunity to present a closing argument, the mischaracterization of her testimony, violated her constitutional right to due process. Now, USC 1252A2B is a jurisdiction-stripping statute that provides that courts are not allowed to review discretionary decisions, including cancellation of removal applications. However, Congress saw fit to restore jurisdiction in subsection D there, which allows for review of constitutional issues or questions of law. Now, here this court has held on...
So your position is that she's only raising pure questions of law, right?
Questions of law as well as constitutional questions, mm-hmm. and that her right to due process was violated.
Can you explain how her challenge to the IJ's factual findings and alleged mischaracterization of her testimony qualifies?
As a question of law or as a constitutional?
As a question of law.
As a question. Well, we're asserting that it's a violation of her constitutional right to due process.
Well, she doesn't have protected liberty interest in a discretionary decision.
Well, we're arguing that she does, essentially. When Congress restored the jurisdiction statute, they essentially granted her a liberty interest here. This court has held time and time again that asylum proceedings, that an applicant does have a liberty interest. And ultimately and inherently, asylum proceedings and cancellation removal proceedings are both discretionary decisions. The Attorney General may grant those after a full development of the record. So we're arguing that since this court has extended a liberty interest and the right to due process time and time again to asylum applicants, they should afford that same constitutional protections to applicants for cancellation of removal.
And what's your best case that supports your argument that she has a liberty interest in remaining in the United States?
Well, we're saying in Podio versus INS that asylum applicants have been granted a liberty interest here. We concede that some of the support that the government has cited. This court has held that there is not a liberty interest in in cancellation of removal applications, but we posit that because they've afforded it to asylum applicants, there should be no difference. It's counterintuitive to believe that that Congress would have restored this jurisdiction to review constitutional questions, not assume that they had a protected constitutional interest.
But thus far, no court has bought your counterintuitive argument.
That is correct, Your Honor. Assuming that she does have a protected constitutional interest, the due process affords her a full and fair opportunity to be heard, and we believe that that was not the case here. This case actually addressed, as far as the closing, it addressed this issue once before in the 1963 decision, Yap versus INS, which the court actually held that the failure of the alien to be afforded an opportunity to give a closing argument at that point was not a violation of her constitutional rights. However, the court noted that it would undoubtedly be better practice in the future to allow aliens to present closing arguments prior to rendering a decision. And they also noted that closing would have added nothing to the record at that point, thereby seemingly opening a door to applicants in the future arguing that they may have suffered a specific prejudice, which we argue.
Let me ask you this. Was there a challenge to the IJ suggestion that you reserve on the closing argument?
It did not seem to be a suggestion. He just asked that you reserve, and he said that it was because of time constraints and the fact that he didn't think the record would be fully developed otherwise, that he was going to cut it off. There was not an opportunity for the attorney to present a closing argument at any other time.
Right. Was there any objection made once
IJ
made that statement, to preserve that issue?
No, there was no objection.
So was that waived?
I don't think it's waived. In the context here, again, the immigration judges are afforded broad authority here. In the proceedings, the immigration judge essentially cut it off. Had he objected, I don't think that's waived, because I don't think the immigration judge would afford them the opportunity to end their time. They're not going to reconvene individual proceedings at some point, just to allow him the opportunity to present a closing. And the immigration judge rendered his oral decision only moments afterwards.
Well, given the broad discretion of the ALJ to conduct these proceedings and the marginal difference that a closing argument might have made, and therefore you've got a prejudice problem, it seems to me your stronger argument is the one having to do with the issue of the father being in removal proceedings, given that the ALJ premised a large part of the decision on hardship, on the fact that the children could stay with the father. And if he's at risk of removal and the decision below didn't really grapple with that, it seems to me that's your best argument here.
Well, I would agree that's certainly a great argument to make. And we argue that falls under the questions of law jurisdiction-restoring statute here. This circuit has actually held pretty narrowly in their interpretation of what constitutes a question of law to be only pure questions of law. This stands in a little bit of a contrast to the 2nd, 3rd, 8th, and 9th courts, who have held that if factual findings are based upon legal error, that is actually reviewable under the 1252A2 standard. This court in Sevilla versus Gonzalez set forth its strict interpretation, but that was based upon a 2nd Circuit decision of Chen versus United States Department of Justice. And in the Sevilla decision, they based it on the analysis in Chen, which was actually reviewed and revised 11 months later, in which Chen specifically held that factual findings based upon legal error are reviewable questions of law for this court. We would urge this court to adopt the more expansive view in line with the other circuits, and particularly given that fact that there were several legal errors here, including the one mentioned by Judge Sykes, that he failed to consider a potentially dispositive issue of the father's removal. If you read through the decision of the immigration judge, it's based almost primarily upon the financial assistance that the father can provide to the children should Ms. Champion be removed to Nigeria. Makes only a passing reference to his potential removal, showing that the judge was indeed aware of that, but his reference to it is only applicable to the fact that Ms. Champion and the father of the children were not married at that time. So, therefore, assuming that he ignored this dispositive legal error, which this Seventh Circuit has held that ignoring a dispositive issue is a legal error, we would counter that the BIA incorrectly applied their clearly erroneous standard in reviewing the factual findings. They were tainted by both the failure to consider the dispositive issue and the mischaracterization of her testimony and the failure to present a closing argument. All of those compounded to really question the accuracy and the credibility of the factual findings here. Going back to the due process argument, we would also, one last argument is that assuming that due process applies here and she has a right to a full and a fair hearing, was also improper by the immigration judge to have referenced the withdrawn allegations of visa fraud in his decision. Initially, when she was put into removal proceedings, they had made these allegations that these were withdrawn, and the only allegation that was on the record was that she had overstayed her initial non-immigrant visa. this court has held in Zhang versus Gonzalez, albeit in the context of an asylum claim, that it would be improper for an immigration judge to have even referenced withdrawn allegations. And this is because an alien would have no reason to suspect that these would surface in a decision, and they may not have been afforded the opportunity to address or defend themselves against this these allegations. Here, we're arguing that's the same issue. Ms. Champion did not have an opportunity to present testimony or defense to these withdrawn visa fraud allegations. Despite that fact, the immigration judge referenced them twice in his decision, even noting that the records, these allegations had not been fully developed for the record. I think this is the specific prejudice here is that it calls into question whether this she received a full and fair hearing and whether or not the immigration judge remained entirely impartial as to these withdrawn visa fraud allegations.
It seems to me the judge acknowledged that that was no longer a ground. The record had not been developed, and implicit in that acknowledgement is the conclusion that the judge didn't take that into consideration. Why isn't that a fair reading of the record?
I mean, that may be implicit, but it's also implicit the fact that it was on his mind when he was rendering his oral decision. And again, as Zhang puts out that, and again, as Zhang, he based a large premise of his decision upon the actual withdrawn allegations themselves. But here, the fact that it was even on his mind in reference, not only in the initial factual portion, but in the analysis as well, it goes to show that he had taken it into account in some context in his decision.
That were so, we would expect to see at least some development in the decision on that issue, and there really isn't.
I understand that, Your Honor. It was only mentioned the two times that we had referenced.
And wasn't he just sort of ruling that out as the reason? I mean, in terms of, wasn't he really trying to make a complete record in terms of what was really considered and what wasn't?
To a certain extent, Your Honor, I would agree. And again, much of it was based upon the financial assistance provided by the father. But the point that it was even referenced and surfaced in the analysis shows that it was on his mind, I believe.
Would you like to save some time for rebuttal?
I would, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Floss. Ms. DeAngelis?
Good morning. May it please the Court, Kate DeAngelis for the Attorney General.
And can you tell us right now where things stand in terms of the husband and the removal proceedings? Where along the line are we?
Yeah, I actually verified on Monday that there is a hearing scheduled for August 13th, 2010. It's a preliminary hearing. I couldn't get any further information from DHS about briefs or any information that was filed in the case. So that's the only information I have.
And what about Mrs. Champion's son, Toby Adeyemi? Is he under removal proceedings?
He is in the same removal proceedings. At least he has a hearing scheduled for that same date and time.
Well, if the father and the brother were removed, then the two preteen daughters would be here without any immediate family.
Well, just to step back for a minute, I would suggest that this is a factual determination that and a discretionary determination that the court lacks jurisdiction to review under 1252. With regard to the father's status, though, to answer the question, the immigration judge did mention that the father could be responsible for taking care of the daughters. However, when the board reviewed the case, they also acknowledged an important fact, which was that Ms. Champion has two sisters who are U.S. citizens and who reside nearby in the United States. And she also has a 20-year-old son who's currently in the United States, who is the subject.
Well, he's the one who's subject to removal proceedings.
Right, but I think very relevant are the aunts. And in fact, the daughter who testified in immigration court testified to the fact that she had a relationship with these women and that, you know, they were, one of them is a doctor, and that they, you know, they do live nearby. So, you know, insofar as the court would reach that discretionary determination, certainly the board's, you know, gave a good sort of backup plan, I would say, to the father being the only person to take care of the teenage daughters. Also, you know, it is the alien's burden of proof to raise, you know, to make her case before the immigration judge. And the issue of the father could have been presented more clearly. It could have been, you know, they certainly would have had more information to give the immigration court about the father. And, you know, they chose not to for whatever reason. So it is the alien's burden of proof to establish her eligibility for this form of relief.
How old are the two daughters now?
I believe right now they are 14 and 16. That was just my calculation based on the dates and the information in the record. So just to, you know, for a brief overview, As I said, I feel that the court lacks jurisdiction in this case under 1252. It's fairly clear under the statute and also under this court's precedential case law. With respect to the due process claims, again, we would assert that there's no jurisdiction in this court because these claims are simply not colorable. First of all, as the court has already discussed, she does not have a liberty interest in cancellation of removal as discretionary relief, and that is very well established in this circuit. In a case that I cited in my brief, Kahn, a 2008 decision where the court said that the Fifth Amendment due process rights, quote, do not encompass proceedings that provide only discretionary relief because an appeal to discretion is not a substantive entitlement. So it's well established that she does not have a liberty interest. Even assuming, arguendo, that she did have a liberty interest here, she just was not deprived of a full and fair hearing in this case. And I take issue with the notion that counsel or that petitioner did not have an opportunity to fully discuss the circumstances of her case before the immigration judge. As I pointed out in my brief, there are several instances in immigration court where counsel had ample opportunity to raise any issues that he felt or clarify any misunderstandings. Just a few after direct examination, there was no evidence that he was rushed, and he wrapped up questioning on his own. That's at the record at 155, telling the judge that he had no further questions. Again, on redirect at 196, he had an opportunity to redirect. He quickly wrapped up, saying no further questions. And then after the judge determined that he would not hear oral argument, he again provided an opportunity for further statements. And, you know, counsel didn't raise any issues at all. So we feel that she had a perfectly fair hearing and every opportunity that she needed.
Well, isn't it possible, as counsel said, that the IJ considered the marriage fraud allegations for credibility purposes? His argument is it was mentioned once in the factual scenario and then mentioned again later in the decision.
Well, I mean, I think it's clear from the record that the judge was, in fact, just reviewing the record in his decision. He was acknowledging that that material was in there. He was acknowledging that the government had stipulated to good moral character. He was acknowledging that the marriage fraud would have gone to a good moral character determination, but it was likely outside of the 10-year time frame. And so, in my opinion, from the record, it's clear that he was making those statements to make sure that everybody knew that he wasn't considering that information in his decision. So, you know, that would be part of our argument that sort of as a third contingency, if she makes it through the liberty interest and through a showing of not having a full and fair hearing, that she hasn't shown any prejudice. She certainly didn't show any prejudice by the lack of a closing argument. As I mentioned before, she had plenty of opportunities to raise all of her claims. There's no statutory or regulatory provision that provides that an immigration judge has to hear a closing argument. This court in YAP has recognized that while it can be effective and helpful sometimes, it's certainly not required. And so we would argue that she certainly did not suffer a due process violation. So in short, we feel that there's no jurisdiction before the court because it's an unreviewable discretionary determination that does not raise a colorable due process or a valid legal question. So if there are no further questions, thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. DeAngelis. Mr. Floss, how much time? You have 4 minutes, Mr. Floss.
Again, just a few more points. To the government's point, yes, the burden of proof is on Ms. Champion, but this goes back to our initial argument from the get-go that she was not afforded the full opportunity to meet that burden of proof and to present her testimony. And contrary to the government's position, we don't think that she was given several opportunities to present testimony as to the hardships. The government cut her off several times after she had testified, yes, I will leave them here, but I will take them with me. I don't know what to do. And again, at the end, contrary to the position taken by the government, when the immigration judge asked for a further statement after that, he had already foreclosed counsel from giving a closing argument. So I don't think that counsel would have been afforded the opportunity to give an elaborate closing at that point in time.
Do you know what the asserted grounds for the removal of the father are? Is it a visa overstay?
It is a visa overstay as well. I believe he is seeking both cancellation of removal, but also I-751 removal of the conditional residence based upon the green card that he had received via marriage.
And he's still a practicing medical doctor?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And the hospice center that she's running information on that?
The hospice running, a Peace Hospice, is still up and running at this point, yes, and employing approximately, I think, 25 to 30 people. If the court has any further questions? Thank you.
No, thank you, Mr. Floss. We thank you, counsel, for your fine arguments and for your briefs. We will take the case under advisement and call the third case of the day, Parvati versus City of Oak Forest, 091.